So thank you so much. I see that everyone can hear me all right. So I think that we'll just go ahead and get started here. Okay, so thank you again for joining us. If you're logged on and you're here for the Fulbright Scholar in Residence Program Overview, this is one of our very last in a series of webinars for the Scholar in Residence Program, all geared towards the host institutions in the U.S. As they're completing their applications. This is one of our last call webinars, so what we really want to do is hear questions from you, from everyone as they're going through the application process, since we're coming up to our deadline here on November 1st. This is round one of the last call, which I know is slightly contradictory, so we'll actually have a final last call in October, on October 17th, I believe, so you're welcome to join in then also. I think that you all got a feel for how to work with the system here with GoToWebinar, but what you can do is just type in questions along that sidebar. They'll come to me and my team here, and we'll try to answer some questions as we go through, and if not, we'll have plenty of time towards the end of the webinar to answer any lingering questions that you have. The session is being recorded, so it will be shared online, and I'll show you our website in a little bit also where you can access previous recordings of webinars as well. And with that, I just want to introduce myself, the people that I have online with me here, and then we'll just get started. So my name is Kaylee Atwater. I am a placement advisor at IIE at the Institute of International Education. I work with various Fulbright programs and other programs, and I do work a lot with the hosting institutions in the U.S., so I'm looking forward to hearing from you all and to working with you in the coming months, too. And then I am joined by my colleague, Susan. Susan, if you wanted to introduce yourself.
Thanks, Kaylee. Hi, everyone. I'm Susan Mundell. I'm the Assistant Director for the Multi-Regional Fulbright Student and Scholar Programs here at IIE, welcome. Thank you for taking the time to tune into our webinar.
Thanks, Susan. And then we usually have David Levin on the line with us. He is from U.S. Department of State Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs. He unfortunately could not come today because he's at a conference, but he is a wonderful resource. He said that we can definitely connect people with him who might have questions in this webinar that he'd be best to answer. And again, with those recordings, he's been on all of our other webinars, so you can get a take on his perspective from Department of State by listening to those, and he'll also be at the final last call in October. Okay, so as I mentioned before, the goal of this session is to really provide an opportunity to answer your questions about the 2020 and 2021 application process for the Fulbright Scholar in Residence Program. We will, again, save time for a formal Q&A period at the end, so type those questions in as they come up. I will also spend a little bit of time walking through the application platform and just showing you a little bit more on our website and some more specific resources. We did have a separate webinar where I walked through every question I think of the application, so tune into that if you want to have it open on your screen while you're going through the application yourself. I know that one's been really helpful. So during today's session, we'll provide a general overview of the program. We'll be providing some insights from that we typically hear from State Department, but we'll be getting into those a little bit today as well. We'll be talking about some trends within the program and some application resources, and we'll also look at the attributes of a successful proposal. So if you haven't already, again, go and take a look at the previous webinars. Those we had co-facilitated with previous SIR or current SIR hosts, which I know is a wonderful resource for attendees. We had a couple of peer-reviewed committee members on those sessions, and we even had one or two scholars themselves, so those are great. And just one quick note that the Scholar in Residence Program is institutionally driven, so it's the U.S. institutions who are completing this application. So if there are any visiting scholars on the line, which I know there sometimes are, just note that the resources and topics that we're talking about here are geared towards potential hosts in the U.S., so definitely connect them to these resources or to us directly. So without further ado, let's get started here. First, and I know if you've listened in on a Fulbright webinar before, then you've heard this, but just a very brief history for you about the program itself. So the Fulbright program was established in 1946 under legislation that was sponsored by Senator J. William Fulbright, and it's now well past its 70th year, but the program itself is still vital to the changing U.S. higher education landscape. It's foundationally a public diplomacy initiative, and it's meant to facilitate international exchange and establish mutual understanding. You'll hear us using that term frequently, too, that mutual understanding. As many of you know, of course, Fulbright is a big umbrella program for many programs that fall under it, one of which is Scholar-in-Residence. So we are sending, under that larger umbrella, we're sending U.S. academics and professionals overseas, and we're also bringing scholars and professionals from abroad into the U.S. The program is sponsored by U.S. Department of State, Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs, which I had mentioned before, and it is administered by the Institute of International Education, or IIE, which is where Susan and I are. Okay. Now I'm going to hand it over to Susan for a moment just to talk about diversity and inclusion.
Thanks, Kaylee. So the Fulbright program strives to ensure that it reflects the diversity of U.S. society and societies abroad. We encourage the involvement of people from traditionally underrepresented audiences in all our grants, programs, and other initiatives. The Fulbright Scholar in Residence program specifically furthers this goal by assisting U.S. higher education institutions in expanding programs of academic exchange by supporting non-U.S. scholars through grants for teaching at institutions that might not have a strong international component and or serve minority audiences. And we'll talk about a little bit later on about which institutions generally have preference under the Fulbright Scholar in Residence program. But obviously it is open to all U.S. institutions. And certainly an advantage is to partner with one of these institutions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. Thanks, Susan. And I know we'll look a little bit more into this in a minute, too. Okay, so as we've been touching on a little bit, the Scholar in Residence program is really a wonderful opportunity to bring scholars and faculty members to campuses that might not otherwise have the opportunity or the resources available to host scholars or have a strong international presence. So the scholars that come through this program are, they primarily teach undergraduate courses for either a semester or a full academic year. The Scholar in Residence, they're there to really help internationalize campuses and curriculum. So sometimes they're developing exchange courses moving forward. There's other outcomes and impacts, which can be virtual exchanges, online courses, even MOUs that are established afterwards to further research collaboration. So the SIR is intended to provide a cross-cultural international perspective for your whole campus and even your greater community. While there are, at any given time, over 900 Fulbright visiting scholars on campuses around the U.S. under that larger umbrella, what really sets the Scholar in Residence program apart, aside from the fact that it's institutionally driven, so it's actually the institutions applying, it's that these scholars are just truly highly integrated into the campus and community life. So they're teaching courses, they're engaging with campus culture, they're often, as you may have heard us say before also, they're all-stars, and they tend to be very visible in the larger community as well. So if you listened in on any previous webinars, and you'd see pictures of the scholars engaging in different organizations or with a community initiative along with the institution that they're affiliated with, and it's just really wonderful, of course. for us to see. As we said, the application is initiated by interested U.S. institutions. So, again, to any foreign scholars who may be listening in right now, you would first need to identify a potential host and discuss motivations and goals, and then the institution is the one to apply to host you as one of the components of their scholar in residence application. The application did open in March. It has a deadline of November 1, and don't think, though, that it's too late to start an application. It's not at all. We'll discuss later on in the application or in this webinar all of the resources that we have available to aid institutions in submitting really well thought out proposals. And we also have our email listed here at the bottom, that sir@iie.org. So reach out to us and we can talk about the application process or any other questions that you have after the webinar. Okay, so here we have, and I won't read all of these priority institution types, but these are the institutions that are typically served by the Scholar in Residence program. So this program is really targeted at institutions that have infrequently or maybe never hosted a visiting scholar on their campus, and they serve underrepresented audiences. So just take a look at those. You know who you are. You know if you fit into these categories. And I'll also say that if you don't fit into one of these categories, you can also reach out to us because there is the option of submitting a joint proposal with another institution. So if you're a larger institution and you don't necessarily fit one of these categories, there's very likely a community college in the area that you have already have ties to, or you might be engaging with for certain initiatives. So that would be just a wonderful way to get involved with them and with the community by submitting a proposal together. And Susan, did you have anything that you wanted to add about like program benefits for these underrepresented institutions, anything along those lines?
I think the biggest benefit is the fact that the program will pay for the grant. So all of the living expenses, we also provide support for dependents, insurance. So the basic grant for the individual scholar is covered by the program. So if your institution doesn't necessarily have the resources to support a scholar, that's where this program comes in to provide that.
Yeah, exactly. And we do get a lot of questions about financial resources available or what the financials look like. So we can get into that a little bit later also. I'll open up some sections on our website. Okay, so we can jump into, and again, we are, I know, going more quickly through this, because in our other webinars, we really took our time in going through different pieces, so we want to get to your questions. But if you need me to pause at any moment or you want me to expand on anything, then just type it in and I'll either be able to now or towards the end of the webinar. Okay, so we have the review process and the timeline open right here, and there's one item that we don't have on this timeline, and that is the draft proposal submission. So that's one benefit that we offer through the Scholar in Residence program that you don't often see in others, and that is that we encourage institutions to submit draft proposals to us. We'll review them and provide feedback. These proposals are due no later than October 1, and you can just send them along to sir@iie.org. And that just allows us to have some time to provide helpful feedback and thoughtful feedback. And it usually leads to phone calls between us, or we can sometimes also do it just over email, which is sometimes how it just winds up happening. You're welcome to submit them earlier. Of course, before that October 1, we've already had some coming in, so this just does give us a little bit more time to review and provide feedback. if you don't have a draft proposal completely ready, I'd say go on in and at least get that application started in the system so that you can get a feel for what we're asking for, what you might need to be gathering. And if you just want to bounce ideas around, if you don't have the proposal completely ready, then you're also welcome to do that either today or by just sending us emails on any other day too. Okay, so the due date is November 1st. That's that first also starting, kind of kicking off our timeline for us. Right after the deadline and a little bit beforehand also, we conduct technical review just to make sure that all components are included. The goal of technical review for us is not to eliminate anyone. If we see that something's missing or that you accidentally submitted a blank page, then you'll hear from us and we'll just ask you to resubmit something because we really do want to help you as the hosting institution craft something that could lead to a successful grant. And then after that technical review, which is when you may be hearing from us, we release the applications to our external review committee. The review committee usually meets in early December. They are assessing the proposals, and after the committee is completed, we reach out to institutions in around January to notify of the review outcome. We then have Department of State and the Fulbright Foreign Scholarship Board. They are also reviewing the recommended proposals. And a few things are happening at the same time here. So IIE is also confirming institutional funding and commitments. You may have seen that there are two routes that you can take for completing this application. You can either name a scholar that you already have connections with, or you can ask for scholar recruitment. So this is where the process looks a little different too. So we're either confirming named scholars, or we're, at this point, in January through April, recruiting the scholars abroad. If you go that recruitment route, then we'll provide the host institutions with any recruited scholar information for their consideration. So we'll send you the candidate information, and you'll make the final decision as to who best suits your campus and your goals. And then from April to June, we issue the grant packets to the scholars once we have all of the approvals. And then around now in September, and that's where the fall grant starts, but then we also have some spring, we are seeing the hosting institutions welcoming the scholars on campus, which is very exciting. Okay. Now, just jumping into a little bit of the review criteria. So once you move forward with your application, I know that it's helpful to see what that external review committee is looking for during that review panel in December. A lot of these criteria that you see on the screen are very closely tied to these application guidelines that I'm going to direct you to in a few minutes too. So just really make sure that you're in those guidelines as much as possible. But the committee is really reviewing to ensure that all pieces of your proposal are working together and give them a picture of what you're hoping to accomplish through hosting a scholar in residence. So they'll be making sure that the short-term and long-term goals line up and seeing how the scholar in residence will contribute to these goals. So things to think about are if the proposal that you're submitting is feasible within the time period that you're requesting, what types of community outreach and engagement you're including, if they're also looking for campus support and to see that the scholar isn't necessarily residing and benefiting in only one department at your institution. So just really take the time to think through all of these elements, the sustainability element, and again, we've talked through this a lot in some of our other webinars, and it's really listed out in the application guidelines, too. Okay. Going to jump into application resources here. So I'll actually come back to this page in a minute, and I'll actually open up the website and the application guidelines So I will jump into the Outreach Lecturing Fund quickly, just because the Outreach Lecturing Fund really plays nicely into the institutions that we see applying for Scholar in Residence, the Scholar in Residence program as well. So as I had mentioned before, there are at any given time around 900 visiting scholars in the U.S. through Fulbright. They can be researching or teaching at any institution. So what the Outreach Lecturing Fund allows for you to do as a U.S. institution is you can search through a list of the visiting scholars who are in country. And if you have a lecture series that it would be great to get international input on or the international perspective on from a certain area, or if there's really any number of ways that you could take this, and it's just a nice way to get your feet wet on what it takes to host a scholar, starting with a short-term basis and then growing. So what you can do is look at that list of scholars, and you can put in an application to host one of those scholars for a short term. There's more information on here. You can email olf@iiu.org, and that they'll be able to give you much more information. And you can also take a look at their website online, too. Okay. And Susan, was there anything that you wanted to add so far before I get into the website?
Just that the OLF is a really great opportunity to host somebody for short term. Could be to give a lecture, presentation, or part of a broader, let's say, conference that you're running if you need a speaker. So it's a really great way to further internationalize your campus. And they're offered throughout the academic year.
All right, great. Thank you, Susan. Okay, so I'm seeing some questions streaming in here. What I'll do is open up the website, and while we just are doing that, I might take a minute to gather some of those questions, so just bear with me for a minute here. And I will also say that the mouse that I am using is very slow, so I apologize if it's taking me a long time to get places. Okay, so just to start, I want to show you the website itself. So what you can do is just go to cies.org, and then you'll go to Program, your U.S. Institution, and then Scholar in Residence, and that will take you to our overview page here. A lot of this is information that we had already discussed in the webinar. And then down here under resources, these are all of the webinars that we had hosted previously. This is the one that we're in right now. And then this is the final, so on October 17th. That will be that where you can send in any last minute questions that you might have as you're getting ready for that November 1 deadline. There is some really wonderful information on here, so I'd encourage you to take a look if you haven't already. I think that this FAQs page is very, very helpful, the timeline we've seen. And then this application page is where I spend most of my time, and I encourage people to bookmark it if at all possible. This is the link to the application itself. This is to the application guidelines. And then we see more information down here about institutions that have been served previously by hosting a scholar in residence here, some tips for building the proposal, and then just some other information also. And what I want to open, I had already opened up the application guidelines here. Bear with me. There we go. Okay. So this really does break down every element of the application. One piece that we get a lot of questions about is that financial support, so I just want to open that up really quickly. There we go. So we get questions about what the host institution is expected to provide. So what you'll see in the application is that you can enter information about in-kind support that you might be able to make available to an incoming scholar, and also salary supplements. We see any amount listed here. Truly, it's dependent on the hosting institution in the U.S., what you're able to provide. Being able to provide salary supplement or in-kind support, if you can't, it doesn't make or break the application. So don't think that if you're not able to provide it, you can't be applying. That's not true. As Susan said earlier, this program is really intended to help assist those institutions that might not be able to otherwise. So let me scroll down here, though. So this whole section can help to answer those questions that you might have. So this just talks a little bit more about the stipends that are provided to the scholar directly. It talks about dependents. It talks about that and those in-kind contributions that I'm mentioning right now. It talks a little bit about housing, just saying that it's helpful for the hosting institution in the U.S. to provide information to incoming scholars and help them get set up and just find a good location or accommodation for them, since you're the one who knows your local community and can help to make sure, of course, that the scholar is set up for successful on program. The other piece that I wanted to open up right now is, if you haven't made it this far, down to page 19, there's some other questions here listed, but I like page 19 because we have the common weaknesses cited by reviewers. So this, I think, I mean, of course, we want to talk in terms of strengths that lead to successful proposals, but this can just help to give an idea of where the reviewer discussions go. So, of course, some of it we've already talked about. So this one is a little bit more general here, where it's saying that the proposal hasn't addressed all components of the institutional application. So, of course, we want to be sure that you're addressing all of those. But then there's other sections where you can really get a feel for what the reviewers are looking for. So let's take a look here. So the department's commitment is clear, but it's not clear how the impact of the scholar, that a scholar will be institutionalized, or what the real commitment of the institution is. So this is where it can be helpful to get letters of support, if you're familiar with that section of the application. And this is where you can be sure that in the proposal that all elements of the application are really blending together. Because I know that sometimes you might have more than one person writing your proposal or writing this application. So it's really important for you to kind of make sure everything is cohesive before you submit, just to be sure that you're hitting all of the points needed in the application guidelines up above here. So I definitely encourage you to take a look at those too. I'll run back up to the top. Okay. And now I'm going to pause for a minute here as I gather questions, and I'll start answering the Q&A right now, too. Okay, so I see that we have a question about if you are applying as an individual or as a representative of your institution or as of one of those priority institutions that we saw listed earlier. So you'll see when you're in the application, and I actually think I will now go in and walk through the application briefly, that you are applying as a representative of the institution. It is one person technically who's clicking send on that final application, but you'll see that there are a number of places where we're asking for information about institutional contacts who might be involved with the proposal, we require a letter of support from an administrative official who can speak or welcome a scholar on behalf of the institution. So we'll be seeing that in a moment also. So I will jump on in and log in here for you now. So in order to reach this point, what I had done is from the Scholar in Residence page, I just clicked Slate Application, and then it brings me to a page where it asks if I am logging in for the first time or if I'm a previous user. I am a previous user, so I'm just going to log in here. My name recently changed. Okay, so you'll see that I'm opening up the Fulbright Scholar in Residence host. We get some questions about if you have another Fulbright application open or you've had a separate one, are you using the same login information? And the answer is yes, you are. You'd see if you have more than one associated, you'd be able to pick the application that you want, which for me right now is the Scholar in Residence host application. Then I want to open the application. Okay, so again, I'll just do a very, very brief walkthrough right now. If you want the more in-depth walkthrough of the application where I talk about all of these components in detail, then tune into that webinar. So after you log in, it asks for just answers to some of these preliminary questions here, just making sure that you're in the right place, that you are a U.S. higher education institution. Clicking yes here. So then it takes you into a little bit more information. We're asking for a little bit more information about your institution. So this is mostly just text boxes, drop downs. A little bit later we'll be getting into those upload sections. We mentioned that join proposal earlier. If you click yes for this, then it will just double the amount of institutions that we're asking for information about, but I'll just keep it on one for now. So it really is just some of the more basic information. And this is where we're asking if you fit into any of these parameters here. If you click continue at the bottom, it will take you into the institutional contact section. So this is what I had just been talking about in answer to one of the questions. What we want to see here is that the institution has thought through who will be working with this scholar potentially while on campus. We've seen a few different, we've seen this take place in a few different ways. So there can sometimes be a whole Fulbright steering committee, for example, where it pulls in contacts from other departments or from other administrative offices, anything along those lines. Just to make sure that the scholar is truly reaching across campus and the larger community. But then we've also seen, and again, this is just really is based on your institution type and your institution specifically. So we've seen it where there's just one main contact for the scholar, and that main contact helps to facilitate all of the scholar's activities and make sure that they're reaching who they need to reach. So what we're asking for is that responsible administrative official. That's the one who can say on behalf of the institution that, yes, we are able to welcome the scholar on campus. So to ask for more information about them. And then we also have the principal contact for academic arrangements. So that is the person who will be helping with developing coursework or making sure that they are set up in the department properly, everything along those lines too. Okay, so then we get into program information. This is asking for the more basic details of the proposal that you're putting forward, program dates. Again, we're looking at 2020 to 2021. So this is where we see if you're requesting a single semester or full academic year. I had mentioned the salary support and in the salary supplement and the in-kind support, so that's where you'd be able to list just the very basic information here, so you're just putting in a number. And then later in one of the sections of the proposal that you'd be writing, so the narrative of the proposal, you have the option of expanding on what the salary supplement is and why, and also the in-kind support, so what's included in that number. So that's where you'll be able to just give a little bit more information about that. And then this section here, the proposal summary. So this I know is really helpful for the reviewers to see just a very quick synopsis of what you're proposing and what it's all about. So make sure to give as much information as you can here. This is where you're able to say if you are naming a scholar or requesting a specific scholar. So if you are, you'd click yes here. If you click yes, then we ask that you provide a little bit more information about that scholar. If you click no and you'd like to recruit, then you can say the region and two countries that you'd like to recruit from. And then this is really the main essence of the application. This here is where I'd say that you really should refer to those application guidelines that we have open over there because it breaks down all of these sections. So for example, it has subsections under institutional profile for what we're looking for here. So what we like to recommend is that you create a paragraph based on each of those subsections to make sure that you're hitting all the points that we and the reviewers are looking for after the proposals are submitted. So definitely just take a look at those. And then this is where the responsible administrative official that you had just put the more basic information for in a previous section, this is where you're able to upload a letter from them, once again saying, yes, we are looking forward to welcoming a scholar on campus. And then there's just the signature page, and we ask that you review it and make sure that everything is correct and accurate before you submit. Okay, so I think I went through all of that, I know, quickly, and now we'll just get back into the questions. And Susan, again, feel free to chime in at any point if you want. Okay, so we have a question about, so it looks like someone doesn't know the exact program end date quite yet. And to that, I'd say that that's okay. We understand that sometimes things change after you submit an application because by the time 2020 to 2021 rolls around, your institution might look a little different also, or who the scholar would be working with on campus. So I'd say put in as accurate of information as you can. And one of the main things that we're looking at for the dates is to see if it's a semester length or a full year. So if you're able to indicate at least that there, then that's helpful. Okay. Okay. Okay, and we had questions about the joint institutions, so what that might look like. So if you are submitting a joint proposal, that means that you have an institution in your immediate area or in your immediate community that you want to collaborate with in order to bring a scholar in residence onto campus. So what you would be doing, and here I'm actually going to open the application guidelines here. Okay. So what you'll see is that, there you go. So in those uploaded sections, the length of the institutional profile and of the proposal itself, it's a little bit longer for joint proposals because we understand that there's twice the number of institutions that you're providing information about. And as for the proposal itself, you need to be discussing what each institution is bringing to the table and what the needs are of each of those institutions and how a scholar in residence might fit into that. So I'd say that you should, again, take a very close look at all of the resources that we see here and make sure that you're checking all of the boxes for each of those institutions outside of the logistics of the application itself. I'd say that we see it work in a few different ways where there might be, the scholar might be teaching, they might teach a course on one campus and at the same time as they're teaching another course on another campus. We've also seen it where the institutions are requesting a scholar for a full year, so they might be spending more time on one campus in the first semester and then on the other campus in the second semester. But there's a lot of work across both institutions throughout that. So there might be a lecture series that students from the other institutions are welcome to attend. So we see that work in many different ways. And I'd say definitely get creative with it. If you want to bounce around ideas for what that might look like, then you can definitely reach out to us. But we've definitely seen it work in a few different ways. I hope that I answered that question. Okay. Looks like someone asked if there is a preference for named scholars versus recruitment. So that I'd say no. We see both go through successfully. I'd say we might get more named scholar application than recruit, just in general. But there really is no preference on our side or on the Department of State side or even with the review committee. I will say that those applications look a little different from each other, of course, because with the named scholars, you're able to really highlight that specific scholar and what they are bringing to your campus. So you're able to look at their cultural perspective and their experiences and teaching experience and bring it over to your proposal in a very specific way. Whereas with the recruited scholar requests, I know that sometimes it can be a little hard to walk the line between talking about your institution's needs and talking about a more abstract scholar that might be coming to your campus someday. So the review committee understands that, and they are looking at the applications that come in for what they are, if it's a named versus a recruited scholar. So I'd say no, there's no preference for that. Okay. Someone asked how detailed the letters of support need to be and how many, on average, the hosting institution submit. So you saw on the application that you need to have at least that responsible administrative official. You need to have at least that one letter there, again, saying that, yes, you are able to welcome a scholar on campus. And then I have seen anything from two additional letters of support to, I think, 20. So the purpose of that section where you can upload letters of support is not necessarily saying, yes, this community organization will host this scholar on this day for this purpose. Instead, it's just showcasing the community's support of hosting a scholar and saying all of these people are interested in interacting with or engaging with the scholar when they're on campus. So we've seen Rotary clubs or high schools in the area that want to engage with the scholar in some way. We've seen them from other departments in the institution or maybe a career services department too, not just academic departments. So I'd say that it is dependent on your institution, of course, how many you submit or are able to submit. But I'd say the more the merrier, just really any way to showcase the support that's going to be waiting for that scholar. Oh, and as for how detailed they need to be, I may have answered this already, but it doesn't need to be getting all of the specifics because we understand, again, that things change. And just because they submitted a letter of support doesn't mean that the scholar will definitely be engaging with this organization in this way. So, again, we know that with that things change. Okay. Okay. Looks like we have questions about not 2020 and 2021, but the following year, so 21 to 22. That will follow a very similar timeline to this, and more information will be provided in early next year and spring of next year for that phase. And on our website, where I had shown you before, that's where we'll see the webinar schedule also. So that will be updated from this round of webinars to next year's, also next year. Okay. Someone asked what sustainability means under the review criteria on that slide. The sustainability, that is very closely tied to the short-term and long-term goals that you may that you're asked to list in part of your narrative proposal. So really all of these elements are tied together. So when we say sustainability, we mean if you're hosting the scholar on campus, what are you doing to make sure that their reach is going to last long and that their impact will be there after they depart. So you might do things like have other professors sit in on lectures and carry on certain pieces of the curriculum afterwards. We've seen it where in general with the courses that the scholars are teaching, sometimes they're creating entirely new content and an entirely new course, but at other times they're taking a course that already exists and adding an international perspective. So what are you going to do to make sure that international perspective is felt after the scholar departs? Things along those lines. And again, if you have questions about how you can take that question and kind of connect it to your larger proposal, then we're happy to talk about that with you. Okay. Okay. Looks like we have another question about naming versus recruiting a scholar. Susan, I might pitch it to you in a second, but I will start us off by saying, so the question is, if you're having difficulty locating a scholar on your own and what that recruitment process looks like. So I'll say that.
I can jump in there, Kaylee. Sure.
Thank you.
So it's not a problem at all if you're having trouble identifying an individual scholar. The recruitment process essentially is that the U.S. Embassy or Fulbright Commission in the country that you're interested in seeking a scholar from will conduct their own recruitment in that country. So if your proposal is selected, we will then work on recruiting in the individual's country. It could also be if you're not entirely set on a specific country, but rather interested in someone coming from a particular region, then we can also, after the proposal is selected, we can then work with you further to identify countries and potentially conduct recruitment in more than one country in a particular region. And some of those discussions will be had with the Department of State, with the program sponsor. There could be some countries in a particular region that are underrepresented, and so they might suggest reaching out to one of those. That's essentially what the recruitment process will look like. And then based on the recruitment efforts in the host country, in the home country, we will then forward the CV of the nominated individual scholar. It could be one or two. For your institution to then review and make sure that this individual is an appropriate fit for what you're looking for. And then we would move forward from there. If it's not a suitable candidate, then we can continue with recruitment efforts in that country and potentially seek out recruitment in an alternative country. Does that answer the question?
Yes, I do think so. And if any institutions on here, any attendees here want to discuss your specific case further, then we're happy to take this offline and we're happy to have a call with you or correspond with you over email. So definitely always feel free to reach out to us that way too.
And I would say the more information that you're able to provide, probably the easier it will be for us to conduct a successful recruitment to meet your specific needs.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. I know we just have a few minutes left here, so I'm looking through all these great questions that we've been getting. Thank you, everyone. Okay. It looks like we have a question about what the scholars' experience must be in order to come through the program, so a scholar in residence that you're applying for. To that, I'd say we really defer to the host institution to tell us if, as Susan was saying, if, for example, they need to have a certain amount of teaching experience under their belt or if they need to have a certain language level or really anything that you can give us that can help with the recruitment process. If it's a named scholar, the same thing goes. So we just want to make sure that, of course, that scholar that you're naming is set up for success at your institution.
And do they have a terminal degree in their particular field of study?
Okay, we had a question about if this will be available afterwards. And yes, this recording will be available within the next week or more likely the next few days on the website. So you'll be able to access this, and it will be archived soon. I have a question about draft proposals. Those can be sent to sir@iie.org, and I'm on the other end of that along with my colleagues here. So, yes, those can come straight to us. And it is helpful if possible for you to have the application as complete as possible so that we can actually go in and look at your application with you there. But sometimes we also get the components emailed to us directly, so there might be a Word document that you send along, which is also fine. It looks like someone had asked about the joint proposals, this time saying if the institution is in a different state. To that, I'd say we want to make sure that the proposal is feasible and that scholar is able to successfully commute between the institutions if needed. I don't know how far you might be if it's in a different state. So there's just a few elements that you need to think about with that. And again, just reach out to us and we can talk about the specifics for that too. Looks like we have a question about visas. Susan, do you mind taking that one? Just what that looks like for the Scholar in Residence program in general?
Sure. So the individual scholar will apply for a visa in their home country. They do so through the U.S. Embassy in their country. What we do is provide the DS-2019 form, which is the supporting document needed to apply for the J-1 visa. So your institution would not be responsible for providing that, as they're hosted as a Fulbright scholar. So we do take care of that documentation. And then the U.S. Embassy or the Fulbright Commission in the scholar's country will assist with the visa application process.
And I just opened up a line on the application guidelines that speaks to that a little bit also, but I hope that helps. Okay, so I think that about wraps us up with questions that have come in. Okay, so Susan, did you have anything else that you wanted to add towards the end of this here?
No, just if you could pull up the contact information and the different ways that they can follow Fulbright, and also contact us with any questions, that'd be great. Yep, there it is. And then I wish you good luck with your applications, and do encourage you to reach out to Kaylee with any questions you have about the application process. Thanks, Kaylee, for hosting.
Yeah, no problem, and thank you for joining. And again, we'll have another last call for questions October 17th, that will hopefully have David joining us from Department of State. A few other dates to remember: that October 1st, that's for the draft proposals, so definitely get those into us if at all possible. We can take a look with you. And then the final deadline, of course, November 1st. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us today. This is being recorded, as we've said, and it will be published on the website relatively soon. So I hope that this PowerPoint and the resources that we've shown you will be helpful as you go into these next steps over the next few weeks as you're completing your application. So thank you so much, everyone.